country to practice democracy, we're seeing such high violence against the press. So our demands are quite clear. A full investigation to all aggressions against journalists. We have a special prosecution for crimes against freedom of expression, which they have presented no results in the ever. Not so ever. We wanted to say a date, but they haven't presented any results on the murders of Moisés Sánchez, of the murders of Regina Martínez in Veracruz as well. She used to be a colleague with Rubén in the Proceso magazine. So our demands are quite clear. We wanted a full investigation. And I think, yeah, there is a responsibility from all parts of the government, the federal, the state, and the municipal government, for the systematic impunity of crimes against human rights defenders and crimes against journalists. We can actually talk about a systematic impunity because in Article 19 we documented 88 cases since 2000. And none of them
Sebastian, we're going to have to leave it there, but of course we will continue to cover this. Sebastian Aguirre with Article 19, Laura Carlson, Center for International Policy, and Andalusia Knoll, independent journalist. We will link to her piece at AJ+. We have a job opening for social media editor, full-time job. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we're going to talk about climate change and our Chi activists.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com. Or by calling 503-230-2300.
feel like some kind of fool, riding around on fossil fuel. $100 just to fill your car. I hope you don't have to drive too far. Petroleum blue.
Hey. You know, I actually feel like we had a great event in Portland.
It was awesome, man.
It was so cool.
Yeah.
Old time talk. I was so
Nobody
pleased.
Says cool anymore.
No, it's not hip. Nobody says hip anymore.
Actually, they say hip and cool.
Hip and cool?
Yeah, man.
Wouldn't that be cool?
What's old is new again.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Cool. Okay, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show here in Portland, Oregon. And the number to call is 231-8187. We are celebrating the incredibly brilliant action by all kinds of environmentalists to embarrass, humiliate, and even slow down the Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, attempt to mess with the Arctic. I want to mention one thing before we go any further with this. It's the case that the last time they tried to drill in the Arctic, they made such a mess of it. Their various little weird boats drifted off, ended up getting messed up. It was so fun.
Well, not just some weird boats, an incredibly expensive custom-designed circular oil rig.
Yeah.
Custom designed to function in Arctic seas in up to 5 feet of moving sea ice. Think about that for a second. So, yes, their track record is poor, one could say.
I would say so. I want to do a couple announcements before we leap into this. I got this action alert from the Forest Service employees for environmental ethics. They very rarely send out an action alert. Apparently, the right wing, who runs Congress, creepy, they're pushing something called the National Forest Ecosystem Improvement Act. Whenever you see language like that, grab your wallet. A deceptive Orwellian name would cut back on the nation's environmental protections. You out there should really let your congresspeople know that we should leave, particularly senators, leave our environmental laws alone. Vote against Senate Bill 1691.
Okay. Why don't you save your next announcement, because we have a guest, and he is on a clock. He's on the clock.
Okay, go for it.
Short period of time. Okay. With us, joining us right now from City Hall is Dana Haynes, the mayor's spokesman. How are you doing this morning, Dana?
I'm well, thanks. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you for joining us. Just to quickly set the table, last week, 13 rappellers dangled themselves from the St. John's Bridge and, accompanied by a flotilla of Kai activists on the Willamette River, attempted to block the path of a Shell Oil-affiliated icebreaker out of Portland. So when something like this happens in town, what does the mayor think about it?
Well, the first thing we think is, what the hell is that? It was an amazing protest. Something we had never seen before. So the first thing to do in that sort of thing is try and get all of the activists around the table and all the parties and the stakeholders around the table to find out what is the best path forward and try and figure things out rather than be reactive. So we everybody got together, and that was the Coast Guard, State Police, County Sheriff's Office, our folks, fire departments, Coast Guard, and to say, what are our options? What are we looking at? What are the possibilities?
And what did you come up with?
Well, the mayor set three priorities for the city of Portland, and we don't get to speak for the county or the state or the Coast Guard, but for the city of Portland, he set three priorities, and he did it pretty early on Thursday to some of the media. And they were, one, that everybody gets home safe, no injuries; two, free speech, that the protesters get heard; and three, that the rule of law be maintained, and that which includes the free use of the federally designated waterway. So in that order, safety, free speech, and opening up that waterway, those were going to be our priorities. Then we had to just communicate with all the other agencies to make sure that folks didn't have a problem with that.
So having arrived at that position then, does the clock start running on the protest at that point? Is there a plan in place to remove the protesters after X amount of time has passed by?
Yeah, part of the clock was based on when was the ship going to be repaired and when does the ship need to move and what other folks are using the river, that federally designated part of the river. So there were a lot of things going on with the clock that weren't really up to us. We were waiting for that ship to want to move out, and then that was going to be the start of the clock.
I see. So it was sort of the city's default position that, well, if people want to hang from the St. John's Bridge, we'll essentially let them do it until such time as, an unstoppable force meets an immovable object, as it were.
Well, and the secret here is that it isn't our bridge. So we had to say, yeah, we think they're dangling for a couple of days. It's fine from your state-owned bridge. So there was a little bit of negotiation about that.
Your bridge, your danglers, you deal with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh. So how did explain to it, sort of give us an insider's perspective on how things played out then.
Once we realized that the message had been released, and I don't mean to say that the protesters, the repellers had reached Portland or Oregon or the United States, your message was heard around the world. That thing was done. And so far, everybody was nice and safe. So then the third thing was reopening the waterways and trying to be fair about who gets to use the waterways. So a combination of the fire department, the police department, the county sheriff's office, state police began the process of trying to clear three of the repellers out of the way so the boat could travel down. So the boat could travel downriver. We weren't involved with the kayak folks. That was the county sheriff's office and the Coast Guard. So our role was ostensibly the repellers.
So your role essentially was hauling the repellers up onto the bridge or getting them out of there in some way or another. Okay, so I'm a little curious here. So you've got these essentially these competing frames of reference, right? You have the First Amendment, you know, which is a constitutionally guaranteed right of protesters to make their voices heard. You've got laws governing maritime laws governing passage on the waterway. You've got different jurisdictions in charge of the bridge. So how do you do this legal calculus? You know, I'm just a little curious. Like, how do you determine that for a while the First Amendment trumps all else and the protests will go forward? After such time has passed that message that you judge that message has been sufficiently aired, and then other steps are taken. How does that work exactly?
Well, let me speak only for Charlie Hales. I don't know how any of the other agencies did it, but I can tell you what Charlie said, which was, for a couple of days, we're going to lose a lane on that bridge, and for a couple of days, we're going to have restricted access to that waterway. That seems like a fine price to pay for the protesters being heard. So we weren't putting any pressure on that unified command to move faster. Now, we were getting a lot of calls from folks who said, I can't get my car across the bridge. I can't get my freight across the bridge. There's a long delay. Why don't you do something about this? These people are criminals. Why are you coddling them? We were getting those calls. And our response was, yeah, we'll do, everybody in the unified command will make a decision about how to get the waterway open again. But we were not in a huge rush to move the protesters because protesters had found a unique and, dare I say, a hilarious way to make a really serious point. So we weren't putting any pressure to go any faster than the process getting that boat downstream.
So there was some sympathy from a policy position within the city government for what the protesters were doing and why.
Yes.
Okay. So what are the legal consequences, if any, that those protesters will face, both those who hung from the bridge and those who floated in the river?
I have the foggiest idea. That's not our end of the business. So I would check, if I were to find out, I would check with the district attorney's office and with the state. Blocking a federally designated waterway is a federal crime. Dangling from state-owned bridges, a state-owned crime. The DA's office would be in charge. I understand two people were actually charged, a total of two, but I don't know which two they were nor what did they face. That's not really the city's end of the business.
I see. Well, that's I guess that's sort of nice from your point of view.
Yeah.
So what is the city of Portland's position officially with regard to drilling in the Arctic?
The city of Portland does not have a position. In the 2015 legislative position for the city of Portland, we said global warming is a huge issue. We really wanted our state legislature to address it, and we wanted our federal delegation to address it. But the terms carbon and global and warming never appear in that document. It's just simply we're very worried about the environment, and we are going to support both in Salem and in D.C. our delegation in any way we can. So that was the official position. At the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which Charlie goes to every year, they took much the same position. We believe that carbon is a problem. We believe global warming is man-made, and we're going to support legislation to address those things. But things like Senator Merkley's bill were never mentioned by name in either of those documents. Now, Charlie Hales is a guy who lives in Portland and Oregon. He's opposed to Arctic drilling. The city of Portland has never taken a position.
The city of Portland has never taken a position. But it sounds like there is enough resonance with and harmony with the position of the protesters that they were essentially given enough wiggle room, enough leeway to carry out this protest for the better part of 48 hours.
Well, remember, I only speak for Charlie.
I only speak for other
elected officials. Okay. But I can tell you, we weren't getting any pressure from anybody else in city government to move faster.
I see. Okay.
That the consensus was the point they're making is a point worth listening to. And if it means that we have a little bit slower traffic, and if it means not everybody gets access to that park for a little while, perhaps, that's all right. That's the price worth paying.
Agreed, yeah. And that's generally the price that's paid when there's a civil action. When civil disobedience happens, someone is inconvenienced, and that's sort of the point.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Dane, I really appreciate your time, and thank you for joining us this morning.
It was a pleasure, guys. Thanks much.
Yeah, take care. That's Dana Haynes from Mayor Charlie Hale's office here in Portland. I want to come right out and say that this program, neither this program nor this station, has an official position on what the mayor's office happens to feel about this particular action. We led with Dana because he had a very short window of time in which to join us. And I, for one, am very curious about how these decisions are made at a governmental level. What do you do? What don't you do? Why? And for how long do you do these things? And ultimately, who's left pressing charges, if any charges are to be pressed? So that's what happened from a governmental perspective.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad we began with that. We have so much going on. I want to quickly make an announcement. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to take somebody who actually was on the river. This is a celebratory show. I mean, I thought this was, given that it was impossible, really, to block this disgusting plan. We are disappointed in President Obama in allowing this drilling. I think it's a stupid thing to have done or allowed. And I think Shell Oil has notoriously failed the environment. But I want to make this quick announcement on a related but not really issue. This Thursday, there will be a celebration and warning of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at the Portland Waterfront, Northwest NATO Parkway, and Cooch Street. And I'm going to go to that, and I think that's important. And I wanted to get that out there. Let's go to somebody who was on the river. Stan, you were on the river. What happened?
Hi there. Yeah, I'd just like to dispute a couple things also. The bridge, I also live in St. John's.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So I could see what was going on with the bridge. And the mayor didn't need to have a lane in both directions closed, which was making it harder for people to get across the bridge. And I live here, so I did that. St. John's Facebook page, yes. People were complaining and saying, oh, these people are just blocking the bridge and making it tough. But the mayor did that by closing those lanes down. It didn't need to be done. And also, the waterway was open for any ship except the Fenica, because the climbers could raise and lower themselves.
Ah.
So they could raise themselves up if they wanted to for other ships to go through. You know, so they could have stayed. We could have blocked that ship quite a bit longer, but once public opinion starts getting bad when the mayor's especially decided to close the whole friggin' bridge down, and start whatever he was going to do to bring the climbers down. But I ended up getting arrested out there, and I think the sheriff boat that got me was, I think they were Clark County. I'm not sure because I never saw. They never told me exactly who they were. Huh. And they were pretty rough.
Clark
dudes,
County, you say?
Pretty obnoxious.
Clark? Yeah, Clark Washington Sheriff's game. Huh. Now, that I hadn't heard.
No, I saw them. I saw them on the video. As a matter of fact, Channel 8 did a decent bit of coverage on that.
You were arrested. Were you charged with anything?
I was just what they call detained, even though detained ended up being 2.5 hours with zip cuffs on and your arms behind your back, which hurt quite a bit, especially as you get older. And they gave a $500 fine. It's for being in a restricted waterway. But, you know, I got a bruise on my arm. The Coast Guard guys, they were ramming boats. I did see that. But that's where we were taken to afterwards, and they were actually quite cool as we were there, like really cool, except for keeping us zip tied for 2.5 hours.
So you're maintaining that the protest was allowing maritime traffic in both directions, with the exception of the Fenica.
Yeah, I was down there for a long time, both days, and for one, there weren't that many big ships needing to go through. But two, those climbers could raise and lower themselves. I think they were trying to actually stay in the shade of the bridge at some points because it was so darn hot.
Yeah,
I
mean, right.
I was a little disappointed that Greenpeace didn't even try to stay longer, because even their ones that self-repelled, I don't think they had much of a plan to get them down, and they would have still been in the way of the ship if they had decided to.
I actually have a question. How did you know to be there? How did the kayakers, how was word spread?
Well, you know, my girlfriend's friends were part of the whole thing. And so we'd gone down there the first morning, and I wasn't actually part of that group to start with. We were watching. We saw the climbers. I've been to other protests, but I haven't done something that gets in trouble since Rock Against Reagan in, like, 1984 and ended up in juvenile hall. So I wasn't predisposed to get in trouble again. But we watched and sat around for the 2 days, and it was very inspiring, and the climbers were very inspiring, and they're doing such a good job. And Portland Rising Tide was super cool. They didn't maybe seem to be totally organized and know how to stop that ship. So once the police had corralled them all that second day and corralled everyone, the kayaks, you could tell that, oh, they're going to try to come through here. That's what they're up to. They're going to try to get down climbers, and then they're going to keep everyone over to the side. So some of us just signed the waivers real quick for Portland Rising Tide and just jumped in kayaks and went straight out and didn't go over to the police line. So it was harder for them to deal with us. And the ship was stopped again. It stopped and threw it into reverse and stuff. And I think if the climbers would have stayed and a few more kayakers could have gone around, you know, we could have backed it up again that day. Yeah, would have been cool.
Yeah, I want to, first of all, I want to thank you for calling in. We got a lot of people lined up. So unless there's something extra special you want to add, I want to let you go.
No, just kind of that. This is a little bit that it makes, you know, this whole making Charlie seem so cool. I live over here, too. That bridge is a mess all the time anyway. and just to be like, oh, you know, the climbers and the kayakers were amazing. And that Greenpeace had that idea in the first place. It's a pretty amazing idea. And they were being cool, and I went over the bridge a bunch of times. It wasn't that hard to get across, even with one lane closed. They didn't need to do what they did and shut down the whole thing and bring in all the tactical trucks and all that stuff. That was ridiculous.
Okay, thank you very much for the call, man.
Really
appreciate
it. Thank you,
guys.
So is that caller's position that shutting the two lanes down on the St. John's Bridge was an unnecessary step by the mayor's office?
Yeah. Well, that's a judgment call.
That is a judgment call, obviously. And I want to reiterate again that the fact that we had the mayor's spokesman on to lead off the show was a matter of timing and not one of affinity or endorsement. The city of Portland has a very checkered past dealing with protests. I've witnessed some of this firsthand. I've seen mace from Portland police splash onto a toddler's face. So there's a checkered past here. But I am pleased that the policy position of the city was such that this protest was allowed to go forward for the time that it did.
Well, and I think in general this was a brilliant action. There was a fantasy that somehow permanently or over the long term the Fenica could be blocked. This is an icebreaker that is required by the government because it has the device that didn't exist when the disaster took place on the Gulf of Mexico. And that requirement is a good thing. That makes it impossible to start the drilling process under the new federal regs. Good thing. But in fact, every minute that the Shell people are blocked from being able to drill is another hundreds of thousands of dollars in cost to them. And it's really important to understand that what's being done in the Arctic is a precedent-setting abuse of the environment, and in fact is nothing to do with the immediate profit of Shell Oil. This is to get themselves in a position where anywhere from 5 to 25 years from now, they'll be able to make an enormous profit on that oil.
Well, there is an angle that has to do with their immediate profit, and we'll get to that in a little bit. In fact, this is a good opportunity to sort of set the table here for what's going on. Underneath the Arctic Ocean is the largest remaining untapped reserves of natural gas and crude oil left in the world. It's a big prize. It's been heretofore inaccessible, because the region is covered in ice most of the year. It's particularly thick and cold in the wintertime. But because of global warming...
Irony.
The ice has receded enough so that during certain parts of the year, it's possible to go up there and drill. Irony indeed. So Shell has been among the international oil companies interested in getting up there. There are a number of countries which border on the Arctic region. Here they are: the United States, Russia, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, because of their control of Greenland, and Canada. Now, all these countries are entitled, according to international law, to drill in the waters off their coast that are considered their territorial waters. What's beyond that, as you get up closer to the North Pole, is international waters, and it's a little less clear about who has the legal right to go after the oil there. So you've got what's a new sort of energy cold war, if you pardon the pun, happening in the Arctic. And Shell has leased a bunch of oil deposits, or the right, this is a very fine point. Shell has leased the right to explore for oil in these areas that it believes contain tappable reserves.
Okay. we're gonna go to the phones. 231-8187. We got Nick Caleb right now. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, man. I'm really glad you're here. I want to hear more about what happened and how, if you want to talk about it, how it was organized and what you did and didn't do and so on.
Yeah, I was in a unique position. I was actually gone for about a month, right up until the day that the climbers came down. So I got off a plane and immediately jumped out on the water and was sort of plugged into some roles. And so I was involved in media liaising for a while and also police liaising during the action. Mm-hmm. And then afterward, I wrote a pretty long article about it to sort of summarize my thoughts on it. And I took a hard line on the mayor, you might say.
Mm-hmm. You want to summarize your thoughts for us right now?
Yeah, I just, I have a lot of a problem with the idea that this was a symbolic protest. And I think you're right that maybe it's unreasonable to think that it could last indefinitely. But what happened is that we set up time for and time and place for moral leaders who have talked about climate change for years and years and years to make a choice about where they stand, in, not just on this action, but in history. We know that Arctic drilling can't go forward. We cannot burn those fossil fuels if we have any chance of stopping catastrophic climate change from coming. The science is really clear. The mayor knows about that. The governor knows about that. We gave them a chance with this blockade to join in. And when things really change in the world is when you have people that go against their sort of trajectories and their expected positions and they take moral stances. And I'm personally extremely disappointed that we didn't get that action from the mayor and the governor.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. There has been a lot of discussion, a lot of writing about when great social change takes place, and probably the thing that happens at the point where the change occurs, not the point where it starts, not the point where the struggle continues, but where it really changes is, as you suggest, when leadership loses the will to demand the reactionary position.
Yeah, exactly.
So right in a very fundamental way.
And, I think that there was every reason to expect that Mayor Hales went above and beyond his position, considering what he'd been saying for the last 6 months. He had 6 months ago or 7 months ago or whatever it was, he was strongly in support of this propane export terminal. the community rose up like crazy, demanded sure. that they take that off the table. He listened, turned to change his mind, to his credit, you know, immediately then went to talk to the Pope about climate change, had been issuing moral language for weeks and weeks and weeks. And, you know, many in the climate movement were like, okay, this person's a strong ally. And so there was every reason to expect that we would maybe even see the mayor out on the water. Who knows? To my knowledge, we never got a call. You know, Dana Haynes was talking about getting everybody in the room, and I think he mistakenly said that they were also trying to get activist voices in the room, because we certainly didn't hear from the mayor's office when we were yeah. down there. And he would have been welcomed with open arms there. In fact, we would have welcomed anybody from the leadership of the city of Portland and Oregon to come out in kayaks. And it's not totally unreasonable. If you watch what happened in Seattle weeks before or months before, when they had the Arctic drilling rig there, the mayor was, you know, using his authority to try to interrupt Shell's permit at the port. You had Shama Sawant that was marching to try to shut down the terminal where it was docked. You had a council member named Mike O'Brien who actually got detained out trying to stop the ship. Like, this is the stuff that needed to happen. We needed to blockade that for as long as possible. And as you're suggesting, maybe we couldn't block it indefinitely, but this is something that the national media attention was on Portland. We had a way to actually stop the ship and keep the pressure on Obama to reconsider his decision. And the way that this went away so quickly, it totally obliterated our chance to make this to the big issue.
Well, I don't know, man. I think a lot of people saw and heard about what was going on. I monitor international media regularly, and this was showing up all over the place.
But not in the New York Times.
Oh, it wasn't the New York Times.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
I missed that. There's really a question. When you say we, who we? Who is we?
I'm using we in a very general manner.
Okay,
sure. One way of thinking about it is us and future generations that need this to happen. And the other is the community that came in support. Like, there are several groups that are identifiable that participated in this action. So I work with Climate Action Coalition that has a bunch of community members. And then Greenpeace was an obvious member. But what was really amazing about this action is that it was so inspiring to people that who aren't political, who would never expect to really be in those positions, were coming down in droves to Cathedral Park, many of them getting out on kayaks, many of them signing forms, pledging to be arrested, saying, we will not let this thing go through.
Yeah.
I think it totally captured the social imagination, like you suggest, not only here, but around the globe.
Yeah, I brought my family down there. There were lots of people on the shore. It was a pretty inspiring scene. And there was sort of this ongoing shouting dialogue going on between the people on the shore and the people hanging from the bridge and the people floating in the river. And it was a beautiful thing, man.
I also want to say one really important thing that we mustn't forget. Yes, it is really hard, if not impossible, to stop the ship forever. But every minute, every hour that ship is delayed means millions of dollars in lost revenue potentially for the oil companies. And since the ice will come back, the very great possibility that the project will not be completed.
Yeah, and, you know, Shell had an injunction against Greenpeace. They actually were earning fines. Greenpeace was making an internal decision about whether they could handle those fines. So in a real way, the law had weighed in and laid the gauntlet. And there was no reason for the governor and the mayor to have to commit any resources to this at all. The stage was set for a totally different battle. My suspicion is they wanted it to go away as fast as possible because, you know, they wanted, I mean, in one of his statements, I think Mayor Hale said, we wanted life to go back to normal at some point. These First Amendment activities can only last so long, and then life goes back to normal. And sort of our position is that, you know, life as it is right now with Arctic drilling coming up is pretty insane. It's not a life that we should be wanting to.
I'm glad you said that, because.
Yeah, and we agree.
Yes, in a very real sense. These were people putting their bodies between that ship and Shell's ability to go forward with drilling in the Arctic. It was an incredibly courageous act, a visionary act, an inspiring act, and frankly, bring it on. Let's do some more.
Yeah, and I just want to apologize for saying the New York Times didn't cover it. They actually did, not as much as I would have liked, but they did cover it. So actually we had in Portland, I think it may have been all three of the major four of the major television outlets usually doing stupid news, actually really stupid news. Actually, we saw KGW preempt the national NBC news, and I believe Channel 2, that is the ABC affiliate, did a similar thing.
So
yeah, everybody was watching, the whole world was watching.
Yeah, really.
What's next in terms of activism on this issue here in Portland?
So one of the reasons why I think the local response was so strong is that we've been organizing very strongly for, I mean, people have been organized on climate for a long time, but in the last 4 or 5 years, this region has really come under attack by fossil fuel industry, setting up infrastructure to export fossil fuels from Canada and the United States to Southeast Asia to support those growing markets. And we're seeing, I think there are now 28 proposed fossil fuel export facilities. And if, I mean, a couple of years ago, Sightline did a report out of Seattle that said that if all of these projects go through and we burn these fossil fuels, it'll be 5 times as much carbon going up in the atmosphere as Keystone XL, and it'll be climate game over. And so we've got a real moral imperative here to stop these export facilities at any cost. And in Portland, you know, we had the Pembina propane export terminal. We have an oil terminal operated by Arc Logistics in Northwest Portland Industrial District. And what we want out of the city is to be the first nation to actually implement a fossil fuel export transport and storage ban, a full ban on this stuff, because we need to set a precedent that can then ring through our region. We need to stop this. It's just as important as the Shell Arctic oil rig.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I have to say that I am not unbiased on this issue. I don't think Abe is either. We both see the climate change thing going on. We both see the idiocy of continued dependence for profit, particularly for profit, on these fossil fuels. And it is really past time to take action individually, collectively, even by governments, to stop this nonsense.
Listen, we appreciate you. Go ahead, please go ahead.
The city is committed. We've heard maybe within the next 6 months to actually having this fossil fuel export policy discussion. And so what I want people to do is be really aware of that and keep an eye on it. Certainly at Climate Action Coalition, we're going to be advertising, you know, every public meeting that there is and inviting people out. But we should be talking about this right now. We don't want some kind of middling position on fossil fuel exports. This stuff needs to stop. We need to have a strong no in Portland. That's the type of moral action that we need out of our leaders in order to be a national leader and to set the precedent.
I got some other people calling us. I really appreciate your comments. I hope you keep us informed. We will do what we can.
Before you go, is there an online resource we can direct our listeners to?
Climate Action Coalition has a webpage. We also have a Facebook page. I think we're climateactioncoalition.org with some dashes between the words on the web.
Okay, so you can Google it, you'll find it. Climate Action Coalition.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, man.
Really appreciate your time, man, and thank you for all that you've done on this issue.
Okay, we have, I think we have other callers coming in.
Before we go there, I want to focus a little more on the economics of this because it comes into play. You mentioned that the extraction of the oil itself, of course, is the basis of the profit that oil companies make. But there's also something else that goes along that figures into the whole stock valuation angle of this, which is also very important when you're talking about capitalists with this much money. Not only are they making money on the back end from what they pull out of the ground and refine and sell, but they make money speculating on the price of their own stock, as it were. And part of the calculus that goes into determining how much an oil company is worth is something called proven reserves. And that is an estimate that each company has of the total amount of petroleum or natural gas that's still underground in the areas that it controls. Now, Shell, not too long ago, got busted for inaccurately reporting its proven reserves and thus manipulating its share price in a way that wasn't honest. And the stuff under the Arctic is big in terms of adding to the proven reserves of Shell and other companies who are going after it, to the point that this drill rig, the Kuluk, that ran aground a couple of years ago, drilled some holes up there, didn't manage to hit any oil, but Shell was able to play those off as test wells and use it to suggest that their proven reserves were larger than maybe they really are. So there's money at play, whether or not they actually strike oil up there, enough money to make it a big freaking deal.
Okay, well, we have a lot of people online. Who's next? Well, let's go to Daphne Weisham because she's really a person who has great knowledge in this area. Daphne, are you on? Are you with us?
I am here.
Tell us what you want to tell us. I leave it open for you.
Well, I was on another interview, so why don't you ask me a question, because I'm not sure exactly where you are in the conversation.
Okay, well, tell us your role. Tell us what you perceive. Tell us a little bit about how things came together and how you think things were either successful or less successful in this action, because this is an incredible action.
Yeah, it was an incredible action. And the Climate Action Coalition really is to be credited for all of the hard work that led up to this action. As I just caught the last little bit of what Nick was discussing, you know, we were absolutely appalled when we found out that the largest pipeline company in the tar sands was planning on setting up a propane export terminal here in Portland. And we mobilized people. We got thousands and thousands of people to write the mayor. That was the single largest investment in Portland history, and he reversed himself. So we did that not just with letters. We did that with nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, bird dogging, reaching out to the press, of course, and we got him to switch his position. So with that in our back pocket, when we found out that the Seneca was coming to town, we said, okay, let's keep doing what we've been doing, which is nonviolent civil disobedience. In this case, we were planning on, we were very inspired by the Seattle kayaktivists. And in fact, the Backbone Campaign was absolutely central in all of this. They helped organize the folks up in Seattle, and they came down and provided their training and expertise and even some of their banners, so we didn't have to create artwork overnight. They had it all ready for us, and we were prepared to basically do a blockade of kayaks on the water, and then at 3 in the morning, we were surprised, wonderfully surprised, when 13 Greenpeacers descended from the bridge and maintained a very effective blockade by air. We certainly couldn't have done it alone, although we would have had a symbolic blockade. The Greenpeace climbers really were the icing on the cake, and allowed our kayaktivists to get some rest and come back in waves, which they then proceeded to do. But as I just caught the last little bit of what Nick said, and I think it's worth reemphasizing, which is the Sightline Institute report that we are facing five times the Keystone XL pipeline here in the Pacific Northwest if we continue with business as usual. And as we know, business as usual is not allowed unless we want to essentially have runaway climate change. So that's one reason why we are blockading not just the Seneca, but there have been some very heroic blockades of tar sands equipment, of bomb trains, of coal export terminals, gas terminals. There are an awful lot of folks in the south of Oregon who are deeply concerned about the LNG pipeline that's being proposed for Coos Bay for export, coming again from fracking to our east. There's another gas terminal being proposed up in Astoria. You know, the Pacific Northwest is really, I think, stepping up to the plate. The people here are just wonderful, and they've all engaged in a very profound way, from kids to retirees to young people, all walks of life. So I encourage people to get involved. We have a group called Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. If you just go to SEEN.org, SEEN.org, you can join our activist network. There are quite a few others, 350 PDX, Rising Tide, Raging Grannies, our Children's Trust, all of whom are part of the Climate Action Coalition. And we've got to get to work. We've got a lot of work to do to stop all these proposals.
Oh, well, we agree with you, but I want to mention one thing that's really important. What is being attempted by the petroleum industry and by the capitalist opportunists involved in all of that is to pit desperately needed jobs against the environment. And this strategy has some potential for working. And I see that in Coos Bay, particularly places where there's a serious depression on, and where they're essentially able to say to people who have to feed their families, look, we'll give you good high paying jobs if you'll just cooperate with us in putting this poison out.
Well, you know, this is the rule of thumb for the extractive industry, whether it's oil, gas, coal, or timber. These guys do not create jobs. They destroy jobs. They destroy a steady economy. They have boom and bust cycles. People have work for a short amount of time, and then they see a devastated landscape and no jobs after all the trees are cut down or all of the oil and gas has been extracted. So, you know, we have to think about what kind of sustainable economy we want to create here in the Pacific Northwest. There are far more jobs in the solar industry right now than there are in coal. In Coos Bay, we need to clearly make a priority of providing the kind of clean economy jobs that we want to bring to the Northwest. Look, it's inevitable. We have to make a switch away from fossil fuels. It does not make sense to be spending billions of dollars on infrastructure that will essentially be a stranded asset. We should be calling for a World War II type mobilization towards a 100% clean energy economy.
Oh, I totally
agree.
As
soon as possible.
If we could muster ourselves to make an atomic bomb, as you just I presume that's your World War II reference, or if we could muster ourselves to put people on the moon, we can certainly wean ourselves from fossil fuels. I have no doubt about it.
Yeah. Or think about the New Deal, you know, how we managed to put thousands of people to work in the aftermath of the Great Depression. We're still recovering from the great, whether you call it a depression or recession, of the 2008-2009 years, and there are an awful lot of people that would love to have jobs building the clean economy.
Agreed. I think we can make the city ground zero for that effort.
And I think this is really a good strategy. I think the argument should be, let's build a healthy environment, a healthy economy. Fracking is insane. We're seeing Oklahoma falling apart, literally. We understand the enormous damage that the bomb trains can do. We understand that this whole business of burning fossil fuels, of cutting down the forests, all of this makes no real sense in the long run, or even in the relatively short run. What really makes sense is to use the power of the sun, the power of the winds, and to produce an economy that supports life on this earth.
Exactly. Yeah, and one of the things that I also want to raise is that the Pacific Northwest, in particular our old growth forests, are the best at storing carbon in the soil of any land anywhere in the country. It's one reason, in addition to the fact that they're under assault and there's all sorts of endangered species that make their make it their habitat. But it's also a key point that preserving forests in the Pacific Northwest helps us cool down the climate, helps us cool down our rivers, preserves our salmon. All of these things are being threatened by climate change. And so we have a critical role to play, not only in restoring our forests here in the Pacific Northwest, if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change, but also in building up a very strong, clean economy locally.
We agree with you, and we really appreciate your time
well
on
said.
This. And I want to thank you for calling us. And I want to remind people that I can't speak for KBOO as a whole, but Abe and I will be working and paying attention to this issue a lot more than we have in the past, I think. And we are very, very, I am very, very proud of what everyone did on the river. And I thought it was very cool. I love the red and yellow banners, by
yes.
the way,
yeah.
emphasizing the role of Shell.
Yeah. I know, that was beautiful. I felt like they looked like giant chrysalises hanging from the bridge with their wings just about to emerge. It was really beautiful.
You know, that I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, that's okay, go ahead.
It may seem almost like an afterthought, the banners that the repellers had streaming out behind them, but I think it's pretty huge. It's much harder to dismiss a thing of beauty like that protest
yeah.
was than it is to dismiss something that doesn't have that aesthetic component. That was genius, yeah. to hang those banners
yeah.
up there.
I think, you know, first we have this beautiful cathedral park bridge, the St. John's Bridge, with this wonderful backdrop behind it of all of the forest that has been preserved as part of the urban growth boundary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that provided sort of the background for this breathtaking and courageous Greenpeacers that were hanging from the bridge, the beautiful kayaktivists in the water. It was, yes, it was about 105 degrees, but that was one reason we were all out there, was because of how warm it's getting. And when that Seneca turned around, boy, I think everybody, even the newscasters, were just, it almost felt like the Tiananmen Square, the lone man in Tiananmen Square that stood in front of the tanks, took everybody's breath away.
Yeah, it's tremendous.
Yep.
Well, anyway, we really appreciate your calling us, and we really, I want to say that I'm committed, and I believe Abe is as well, to pushing this struggle forward, to making sure that the climate is not ending up destroying all of us, though I don't know how well we can do that, and also to making clear to our audience and to the public in general exactly what the role of the fossil fuel industry is in the destruction of the world.
Well, there are two things I just want to make sure I get out there. One is we will be having a celebration / fundraiser for all of the legal expenses and the kayaks and all of that. Rising Tide is currently the repository for all of those funds. So if you'd like to help pay for some of the courageous people that did get arrested and face legal charges, that would be great to go to their site, Portland Rising Tide. And we'll keep you posted on our big fundraiser when it happens. And also, I just want to encourage, especially people here in the local area, please do join one of these groups. Again, our group is SEEN.org, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network.org, which is a project of the Center for Sustainable Economy. We're focused exclusively on the climate and energy crisis.
Say the name again.
SEEN.org, SEEN.org. You can find out more about us there, and you can click on the Join Us button at the bottom and become part of our activist network.
Absolutely, and I encourage people who are listening to the show to do that.
Thank you so much.
Very much for calling.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Neat.
Yeah, this is KBOO.
I feel good for a change.
90.7 FM. Yeah, right? This was a great thing. I'm Abe. That's Joe. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. You can call us 503-231-8187, or if you'd like to leave a comment on our Facebook page, you can do that, facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Brian writes in to say, I applaud the actions of Greenpeace and their in situ supporters last week. I've done my share of this kind of action myself in my hot youth, and it makes me happy that some passion still exists in this age of seeming bread and circuses-induced mass apathy. So thank you for that, Brian.
Yes, yes, and I too, and I have to admit, becoming very bitter and cynical about the general situation, am seeing hope in this struggle.
Now, yes, I see hope as well. And it's important to realize that even though the Faneca made it past the blockade and is now on its way to the Arctic, the clock has not yet run out. Shell is still exploring for oil. It is still drilling test wells. It has not yet set up pumping operations. There is still time to stop this. There is still time to convince the administration to rescind those leases or do whatever legal thingamajig it needs to do to put a stop to this. It is not too late. And actions like this just help it permeate even more into our collective consciousness that this is what we need to do.
And we need to be aware that there's a constant effort at bread and circuses when a doofus with funny hair becomes the dominating candidate for President of the United States in the Republican Party. You know, we really, really have to understand that the circuses, the bread and circuses presented by the so-called legitimate political parties are getting so irrelevant, so stupid, that all of us need to turn our attention not just to these actions, but to beginning to build a real political structure of opposition and potential leadership in this nation.
And it's important to remember, too, that not only would liberating all that carbon from beneath the Arctic Ocean, not only would that be disastrous in terms of global warming, but there's also, again, as always, the possibility for catastrophic failure and an enormous spill of oil. And we really don't know what happens if there's a massive Gulf of Mexico-style oil leak in the Arctic in sub-zero conditions. We really don't know how to deal with that or whether we'd be able to deal with that at all.
Well, and we're already seeing smaller leaks taking place. What happened in Santa Barbara, two different leaks, one from a pipe that was poorly maintained, and the other one is still a kind of a mystery. And the fact of the matter is that this stuff doesn't belong in the atmosphere, doesn't belong on the land, it belongs underground.
It does. Keep it in the ground. It's just that simple.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Shane, good morning. You're on the air. All right, well, let's try and come back to Shane. Francis, good morning. Francis, hi. You're next.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
That was a pretty magnificent and beautiful protest.
It was.
And, I liked that Rachel Maddow likes Portland so much. She had some good shots of it.
Yeah.
Forest Park was gorgeous behind it. You know, I was watching this with an old Vietnam vet I know who is very aware and acutely aware of compromises to your ethics that one finds themselves having to make sometimes
mm-hmm.
in their lives. And so we're watching, he's very supportive of Bernie Sanders, you know, so he's still into justice. He hasn't gotten that cynical. But while we're watching that, he says, those are plastic kayaks, huh? I said, yeah.
Actually, fiberglass.
And they're all fiberglass?
Yeah.
They're not plastic.
Well, I don't know for sure, but kayaks I've been in are fiberglass.
Danny said, I wonder how much gasoline was used to fly the airplanes and drive the cars to get to the bridge.
Well, there's irony. There's irony, I admit.
I said, well, you know, and I would have loved to talk to one of your guests to ask them, what do they say to someone who brings that up, that how much of the product we ourselves are still using? And I don't have a good response to that.
Well, look, I think what
have to use what they got at the time.
What Steve, our wonderful producer, said to us, and you didn't hear it, is we are trapped in this system. We have to use what we have available to us. It would be great if we had an electric train system. It would be great if all kinds of things were here. They are buildable. Yeah. They are doable. But just start with what you got.
Right, that's exactly what I think, you know. And but then you get to the point where do you draw the line, you know? Like Charlie Hale's kind of did what he did, which was kind of cool, but then he had to draw the line somewhere as far as obeying the law.
Well, generally speaking,
it's really it's not that cut and dry. Sometimes
I agree, but generally speaking, I think you draw the line at you stop doing what you've been doing. We stop pulling more oil out of the ground. We stop.
Right.
We look for alternatives to petroleum-derived plastics. We look for transportation alternatives and energy sources and all these sorts of things. It is going to be a massive Manhattan Project-level effort, but we have to do it. We have no other choice.
Right. Yeah,
and I have to say, Francis, listen, there's one thing that we really need to understand. We mentioned it earlier. When the great change takes place, the great progressive change that I and Abe and many others fantasize and believe is entirely possible, it will happen when the ruling political structure fails to have the will to enforce the reactionary activities of the ruling class.
Beautifully said, sir. Beautifully said. And do you know why the media has just decided they don't want to cover the fires in California that are pretty outrageous?
Well, they're covering them. I'm not sure what
you're
meaning.
Well, not like they usually do. I mean, I'm talking about mainstream media.
I think they led with the fires.
While they're talking about Mr. Trump, we've got this, you know, 20, 30 minutes of Trumpdom. Then there's 2 minutes about this devastating thing that's happening in Northern California.
Well, I'm not going to discuss the balance there. It's certainly the case that trumps us all. And I also want to say,
then you might have to talk about the fracking that's being done that's taking up all the water in California, really.
Right. Yeah. Well, the great distractions of our political system are becoming more and more obvious. The danger of Trump, by the way, just really quickly, is we all see him as a kind of an ass. The fact of the matter is that it's very possible that we are dismissing a great danger in that guy. He could.
Well, you know what? You know what? I hope. Do you know how easy it would be for somebody like Bernie Sanders to defeat him? You know, it's like, let him do it.
He has a right. That's all I can say.
I believe that this aside that they give Bernie Sanders is also a plan, but I don't think it's going to work because
we're running out of time, Francis. We got to let you go. I'm sorry.
Right, you guys take care.
You too. Thanks for the call.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's what I say about it.
I agree.
It was a beautiful action. And I want to emphasize, while of course we could not stop the ship, we did delay it. We're causing great distress to the fools who make their money off of the carbon-based fuels and so on.
Yes, and I think it's safe to say we have a local government that's responsive on this issue, so we need to push them to do the right thing.
To move further, much further. Okay, we all are really glad. We want you to stay tuned to KBOO. We want you to join the fight. We want to make the world a healthier, safer, fairer place.
We'll be back at you next week.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Challenging Corporate Rule and Creating Democracy event with David Cobb, Sunday, August 9th, 7 to 9 p.m., doors at 6:30 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church, B102, at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street, Portland, Oregon, sponsored by the Alliance for Democracy, Move to Amend Portland, Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church, the Pachamama Alliance, and KBOO. Move to Amend spokesperson David Cobb is coming to Portland, and he's going to talk to you to join the growing effort to abolish the doctrines of corporate constitutional rights and money as speech. And doors will open at 6:30 p.m.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on alternative radio, award-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges speaks on moral imperatives. At 11, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines